Make yourself comfortable.
Yep.
I'm taking off my shoes. And we're just going to recite this beautiful instructions on how to meditate. This is what
should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that a wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
I normally like to ask people if they, for their input on is there, was there anything that you wanted to maybe tackle tonight. When I was asked to teach, this morning, it actually occurred to me that I actually heard my own voice start to say, yeah, I'd like to talk about forgiveness. And so if you don't mind, maybe we could tackle forgiveness. And the way I do this is actually, there's a beautiful radio show that I like to listen to myself, and this sort of gets me into a very forgiving mode. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to play this little short radio show clip. It's about 10 minutes, and if you have any handkerchiefs, please take them out and have them ready. And then after that, I'm going to do a guided meditation from that, and then after that we'll have a discussion a little bit on what's been going on. So let's hope the technology works.
Really long distance. So remember that tsunami that hit Japan 5 years ago? March 2011, giant black waves more than 30 feet tall hit Japan. A guy in a little town called Otsuchi shot this video. You can hear him yelling. All the houses are washing away. Otsuchi had been there for 100 years. In 30 minutes, it was gone, almost totally flattened. The tsunami and the earthquake that went with it killed 6 times more people than died in 9/11. Over 19,000 people. Another 2,500 are still missing. And in the aftermath, of course, families struggled to figure out how they were going to move forward without the people they loved. And in that town of Otsuchi, it led to this new I don't know, ritual is not exactly the right word for this, but it's something close to that. This thing that people invented to stay connected to the dead. One of our producers, Miki Meek, has family in Japan, and she grew up going back and forth between there and here. And she watched this documentary about this thing people were doing in Otsuchi on the Japanese news channel NHK and got permission for us to play you some excerpts. Here's Miki.
Of all the areas in Japan affected by the tsunami, Otsuchi has one of the highest numbers of missing people, 421. Today, it's still partly in ruins and partly a construction site as they try to rebuild the town on higher ground. But a year before the tsunami happened, this guy named Itaru Sasaki, he was already dealing with a loss. His cousin had just died, and Itaru was having a hard time figuring out how to talk about it. So he did something pretty ingenious. He went out and bought an old-fashioned phone booth and stuck it in his garden. It looks like an old English-style one. It's square and painted white and has these glass window panes. Inside is a black rotary phone resting on a wood shelf. This phone connected to nowhere. It didn't work at all. But that didn't matter to Itaru. He just needed a place where he felt like he could talk to his cousin. A place where he could air out his grief. And so putting an old phone booth in his garden, which sits on this little windy hill overlooking the Pacific Ocean, it felt like a perfect solution. He's saying, because my thoughts could not be relayed over a regular phone line, I wanted them to be carried on the wind. So I named it the wind telephone. Kaze no denwa. The idea of keeping up a relationship with the dead is not such a strange one in Japan. The line between our world and their world is thin. Lots of families keep a Buddhist altar for their dead relatives in the living room. My uncle has one for our family. There are photos on a little platform, and every day he leaves fresh fruit and rice for them, lights incense, and rings a bell. It's a way to stay in touch, to let them know that they're still a big part of our family. So after the tsunami and earthquake happened, word got out about Itaru's special wind telephone, that he was using it as another way to stay connected to the dead. Soon people started showing up randomly on his property and walking right into the phone booth. This has been going on for 5 years now. Itaru estimates that thousands of people from all over Japan have come to use his phone. A TV station asked Itaru and the people who come to use his phone if they could videotape their calls from a distance and put an audio recorder in the phone booth. They wanted to get a sense of how people are still grieving. I watched their documentary after the 5th anniversary of the tsunami back in March. That whole week, all the news programs in Japan were airing memorial programs. But I found the calls in this particular program remarkable and moving for just how simple they were. One woman from Otsuchi, named Sachiko Okawa, showed up one afternoon. She's 71 years old and lost her husband in the tsunami. She regularly brings her two young grandsons to the phone booth. And you can tell by how casually they talk to him on the phone. They squish into the phone booth with their grandma, wearing matching blue and black striped shirts. Sachiko starts the call by picking up the receiver and saying hello. Curled's grandson quickly jumps in. Hi, Grandpa. How are you? I'll be in fourth grade next semester. Wasn't that fast? Daina, my younger brother, he'll be in second grade next year. Then Sachiko corrects them. She says, no, Daina will be in second grade this year. Not next. Yeah, this year. A lot of calls were just like this, straightforward updates about life, the kind of quick highlight thrill you might give to any family member you were catching up with on the phone. The boy, he then tells his grandpa, Grandma's fine too. I'm giving the phone to Daina now. Daina, his little brother, grabs the phone. Grandpa, I finished all my homework. Sachiko urges him to keep talking. He says, everyone is doing fine. Then he hangs up. They all say goodbye. As they're walking out of the booth, Daina says, maybe Grandpa will say he heard us. In another call, a woman in a puffy winter jacket with a fur-lined hood shows up at the booth by herself. Her name is Kikue Hirano, and she's 66. She used to live in Otsuchi. but she moved away after she lost her house and her husband in the tsunami. Her husband was a deep-sea fisherman. His name was Myoji, and they used to talk and drink sake together at night. Now Kikue lives alone, about 50 miles away. But sometimes Kikue finds herself driving back to Otsuchi, into this booth. I watched her do this thing that a lot of callers seem to do. You hear Kikue actually dialing the rotary phone, saying some numbers to herself. 4-2-5-7-4-4. She's dialing the phone number for her old house in Otsuchi, the last place she knew to reach her husband. Then Kikue just stands in the booth in silence, holding the phone to her ear. Sometimes she fidgets around and tilts her head up and concentrates on the ceiling, the same way I do when I want to cry, but I'm trying hard not to. It doesn't work. Kikue brushes some tears off her face. Eventually, she hangs up. She lingers in the booth a little longer, hands clasped together in front of her, staring at the phone booth floor. She walks out. One pattern that the owner of the phone booth, Itaru, has noticed over the years is that more men than women come to use it. Not surprisingly, this is not a demographic that's known for sharing their feelings, especially the older farmers. They already have a reputation for not talking much. In one of the phone calls recorded in winter, a man with gray hair and a little towel hanging around his neck walks into the garden. This kind of towel is part of the uniform of Japanese farmers. They use them to wipe away sweat and clean their hands. This man opens the telephone booth door, and under his breath, you hear him say, "Huh, so this is the wind telephone." This appears to be his very first visit to the phone booth. He lost his oldest son in the tsunami. His son's name was Nobuyuki. He also lost his house and had to move into temporary housing with his wife. And recently, she got sick and also passed away. He calls her Okaa-san. It means mom in Japanese. It's what everyone in the family calls the female head of the house, even the husband. It's a very intimate, loving term.
もしもし?
Hello?
Nobuyuki.
Nobuyuki.
お母さんもいる?
Is mom with you? Sorry to ask this, but take care of her and your grandma and grandpa too. Mom? I'll come again, okay? Mom? I'll be back. Bye. He uses the towel around his neck to wipe his eyes. One of the things that makes these calls so poignant to me is all the understated ways that people are actually saying, "I love you," and "I miss you." I never say something so direct like that in Japanese. It's just not done. I've only seen people say it in the soap operas. Aishiteru. Even saying that right now feels weird. I've never said that to my mom or my grandparents. Take this call. It's winter. The phone booth is surrounded by snow. Hello? Mom? Where are you? He's an older man wearing a baseball cap. He also calls his wife Mom. His wife, daughter, and mother, they all went missing in the tsunami. It's so cold, but you're not getting cold, are you? Our grandma and our daughter, Miyuki, with you too? Come back soon. Be found soon. Everyone is waiting for you. Okay? I'll build a house in the same place. Eat something, anything. Just be alive, somewhere, anywhere. I'm so lonely. He never says I love you directly. Real feelings are communicated through small gestures, especially ones of concern. Like when he asks his wife, are you staying warm? Are you eating? And then promising, I'll build a house for us. These are total heartfelt declarations of love. For other men, the phone booth is a place where they can finally say their complicated feelings out loud. They can voice their regrets. Anyone who's had someone close to them die knows this feeling. Like I've kept having the same one-way conversation with my dad in my head ever since he passed away last year. I just keep telling him all the situations where I wish I had been kinder, more patient. One call I watched was from a young father with rectangle glasses and a long black jacket. He lost his family, both parents, his wife, her name was Nine, and a one-year-old son named Issei. Dad? Mom? Mine? Issei. It's already been 5 years since the disaster. If this voice reaches you, please listen. Sometimes I don't know what I'm living for. Issei, please let me hear you call me Papa.
Papa, って声を聞かせて。
Even though I built a new house. Dad? Mom? Mine and Issei. Without all of you, it's meaningless. I want to hear your reply, but I can't hear anything. He hangs up the phone, takes off his glasses, and covers his eyes with his hands. I'm sorry. I'm so sorry I couldn't save you. There's a couple phrases I heard callers tell the dead again and again. Shinpai shinai, don't worry about us, and gambatteru, which basically means I'm doing my very best. I'm enduring. In Japan, gambatteru is a catch-all slogan for slogging through life's many challenges, no matter how tiny or big. From trying to pass a test at school to grieving, you hear it all the time for everything. In the phone booth, gambatteru and shinpai shinai. These are key phrases to reassure the dead that the living, the people left behind, they're doing okay, even if they're not. People don't want to worry or burden their loved ones, even dead loved ones. Because most Japanese are Buddhist and generally believe that when someone dies, they're not suddenly relieved of all their earthly concerns. They're not automatically in heaven, happy and carefree. Many people believe that if the dead see a family member suffering, they can't let go of their earthly life. They hesitate to cross to the other side and end up stuck in a no man's land. I heard these reassurances in a call from a 15-year-old kid named Ren Kozaki to his dad. He arrived at the phone booth after spending 4 hours on public transportation by himself. Ren lives in a city much farther north that wasn't affected as much by the tsunami, but his dad was a truck driver who drove all over Japan, and in a last-minute schedule change, he got sent on a route that took him along the coast when the tsunami hit. He's been missing ever since. Ren went into the phone booth wearing a red backpack, and what he does in his call, you hear him signaling to his dad that it's okay. He should keep moving on into the afterworld.
What's up?
Dad? The four of us are doing fine. We're gambatteru.
Senpai shinakute iiyo.
You don't need to worry about us. Shinpai shinai.
Masa-san wa genki?
Dad, are you doing okay? I do have one question I want to ask you. Why did you die? Why did it have to be you, Dad? Why just me? I've always wondered, why am I the only one who is different from everyone else? Anyways, please be found quickly. Where are you now? They never found anything of you. I wanted to talk with you again. Ren left the booth. In late February, he came back with his entire family, his mom, younger brother, and sister. They all drove down to Otsuchi together. And when they got to the phone booth, at first, they kind of awkwardly hung out in front of it. So to break the ice, Ren walks in and places the first call to their dad. He tells him, I brought everyone with me today. Bye. When Ren walks out, his family laughs. They say, that was so fast. Ren shoots back. It was just a quick report to Dad that I brought everyone with me today. Next up are Ren's little brother and sister, who are 12 and 14 years old. They go into the booth together, and the sister is talking and laughing nervously. What am I supposed to say? What should I tell him? Wait, don't leave me alone in here. The sister picks up the phone, and let me just say, the mom told the film crew that this is a girl who has not said a single word about her dad to anyone since he went missing 5 years ago. So she picks up the phone and starts to cry. She asks her brother again, what should I talk to him about? Her little brother's name is Riku, and he tells her, say what you wanted to tell him. She says, are you trying to make me laugh, Riku? Riku says, no, I'm not. Then she finally starts talking to her dad. The conversation is all over the place, and she's crying so hard she can barely talk. Dad, I'm so sorry I always used to say you were stinky. What happened to your promise to buy me a violin? Now I'll have to buy one myself. Her little brother, who sticks close to her, he encourages her to keep going. He says, what else? So she tells her dad, I started tennis in junior high school. I'm not in the top 8. I want to be in the top 8 in our last tournament. Please cheer for me. I got hooked on this boy band, the Johnnies, when I was in my first year of junior high. I'm still hooked. They both say, goodbye. They come out of the booth together. Now it's their mom's turn. Her kids tell her, itarashai.
Itarashai.
Have a good trip. Good luck. Ren, the oldest, he bows and waves to her. She walks in, picks up the phone, and lets out a big sigh. Where should I start? I feel like you're still alive, somewhere. We had so many things we wanted to do together. Over the phone, we always said to each other, "Are you alive?" "Yes, I'm alive." It was our password between the two of us, wasn't it? I can't ask you that anymore. Come back. We, all four of us together, we will be waiting. Bye. After she comes out, the family lingers outside the phone booth for a while. This was literally the first time they'd all talked about their dad together since the tsunami happened 5 years ago. The youngest, Riku, he sat quietly on a bench with his head in his hands. The night before his dad disappeared, they went to a public bath together. His mom and older siblings tell him, "Riku, you don't need to keep your feelings in. Go ahead and cry when you want to." Ren, the oldest, gently teases him. He says, "See, you can't stop crying." Mom says, "Yeah, but..." He held back until now. "It's okay, because you held back, you endured, until now." The sister then hands Riku her handkerchief. The mom says to her kids, "We were all about to fall apart. We were so broken. We didn't think we could make it through. And maybe that's why we never talked about Dad until now. But talking to him on the phone today, it changed something."
So I just like to scan down through the different body parts. I'm just going to scan from my head to my feet. And as I go through each area, I'm just going to ask for forgiveness from each part of my own body. So I'd like to apologize and with all my heart to the top of my head. So I'm just knowing the different parts of the body that I'm speaking to. And I'd like to apologize with all of my heart to the back of my head. I'd like to ask for forgiveness and apologize with all of my heart to the right side of my head. And I'd like to ask for forgiveness and apologize with all of my heart to the left side of my head. And I'd like to ask for apologies and forgive with all of my heart the front of my head. And I apologize with all of my heart to my eyes. And I'd like to apologize with all of my heart to my nose. And I'd like to apologize with all of my heart and ask for forgiveness of my mouth. And I'd like to apologize and ask for forgiveness with all of my heart of my neck. And as I come to my shoulders, maybe as if I was out shopping and I would just put down the shopping bags and just let any tension out of my shoulder. And I apologize and I wish to make amends. I apologize with all of my heart to my shoulders. And to my arms, I apologize with all of my heart to my arms. and my hands. I apologize with all of my heart to my hands and to my lungs and my chest. I apologize with all of my heart. And if there's any air or tension in my chest, I breathe in deeply and release any tension or pressure from my chest with all of my heart. And I come to my heart. I apologize with all of my heart and my feelings for my own heart that is supporting my life. And to my stomach and intestines, I apologize with all of my heart. Ask for forgiveness to my stomach and intestines with all of my heart. And to my back, my upper back, middle back, and lower back, again I apologize and ask for forgiveness with all of my heart to my own back and spine and radiating ribs. And I come down to my pelvis and hips. I apologize with all of my heart to my hips and pelvis. And to my thighs, I apologize with all of my heart to my thighs. And to my knees, I apologize with all of my heart to my knees. To my shin and calves, I apologize with all of my heart to my shin and calves. To my ankle, heel, foot and toes, I apologize with all of my heart to my ankle, heel, foot and toes. And then as I put all of these different body parts together, the feet, the legs, the torso, the arms, the neck and the head, let me cradle this body and mind of mine. Sometimes I like to think of the Pietà, that beautiful statue of the Mother Mary holding the Christ. Embracing and holding that child, that inner child, and I forgive with all of my heart this body and mind of mine. And just as I wish to forgive myself, so too do I forgive with all of my heart each and every one of us here in this room. So maybe I can just imagine that I'm radiating outwards like a ripple in a pond or like a light at night, or mentally that I'm embracing and cradling each and every one of you, even as a mother would protect with her life her child or only child, so too do I forgive with all of my heart each and every one of you in this room. And let's spread this forgiveness for everybody in the hospital around us tonight. They may be sick or unwell, or the staff treating and taking care of the needy. I forgive everybody in this hospital complex here tonight with all of my heart. And we just radiated outwards, surrounding neighborhoods of Armidale and Kelmscott around us here tonight. But I forgive everybody all around us with all of my heart. And let's just fill the whole southern suburbs, from the hills to the river, Swan, all around us here tonight. May the whole south side of the city be receive this forgiveness with all of my heart. And we radiate out further the whole of Perth. I forgive all beings in Perth tonight with all of my heart. And radiating out further again now to the whole state of WA, with all of my heart, I forgive all beings in WA tonight. And now filling the whole continent of Australia, the whole island, I forgive all beings in Australia tonight with all of my heart and radiating it out wider to our neighbors, to the south into Tasmania and further east to New Zealand and north into Indonesia. With all of my heart, I forgive our neighbors with all of my heart. And now let's just move north up into Southeast Asia, the whole of Southeast Asia. You don't have to see or visualize anything, but just know the area that I'm talking about. The whole of the south of Southeast Asia, Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, this whole region. May I forgive all beings in Southeast Asia tonight with all of my heart. And let's follow the sun setting into the west. May I forgive all beings in South Asia, India, Sri Lanka, Burma, Nepal, Pakistan, this whole region. I forgive all beings in this region with all of my heart. And moving through the Middle East, Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Israel, Syria, Yemen, Lebanon, this whole region. I forgive all beings in this region with all of my heart. And moving through Africa, from Egypt to Morocco to South Africa, I forgive all Africans tonight with all of my heart. And through Europe, from the boot of Italy to Scandinavia, from Portugal to Turkey, from Russia to Ireland, I forgive all Europeans with all of my heart. And across the Atlantic to the Americas, South America, Central America, North America, I forgive all Americans with all of my heart. And crossing the Pacific to the Far East, to Japan and Korea and China and Mongolia and Tibet and Vietnam, this whole region, I forgive with all of my heart. Even as a mother would protect with her life her child, her only child. And so let's just imagine now we can just embrace this whole planet Earth, this globe, like a football, like a beach ball in our arms, and cradle it in our arms with great forgiveness. I forgive this whole planet Earth with all of my heart. I forgive this whole planet Earth in body, in speech, and in mind with all of my heart. And let me put down this planet Earth and just go over to where the sun is. I like to imagine it's like a lilo floating on a swimming pool, but you can imagine it's like a couch or something very comfortable. And just sitting in this golden seat and just looking up at the night sky in all directions, north, south, east, west, above and below. I forgive all beings in all directions, outwards and unbounded, with all of my heart. As I lie here on my floaty, just very relaxed, breathing in and breathing out, I forgive me and I forgive all beings in all directions. Breathing in and breathing out this connection of suffering that exists between myself and the world and me. And I forgive with all of my heart. just breathing into this act of forgiveness with all of my heart. I forgive. I can just bring my attention gently to my breath, and I can use this mantra of for on the in-breath and give on the out-breath, so that I just really breathe in to this act of forgiveness for self and for other, and other and self, for this breath here and for the whole universe around me, with all of my heart. Breathing in and breathing out. For, give. Forgive me, forgive you, forgive all of us. Forgive body, forgive speech, forgive mind. Forgive north, forgive south, forgive east, forgive west, forgive above, forgive below. Just breathing in and breathing out. Knowing just as I suffer, so too do all beings in all directions suffer in some way. Breathing in and breathing out, and forgiving myself wholeheartedly for this existence of suffering. Whatever pain or difficulty I may be experiencing, that I forgive myself. That at least I take away that sting. I have that power to forgive myself. for bearing up, for getting by in life, for just getting over life's difficulties and hurdles. The greater, the mighty, the medium, short or small, I can forgive with each breath. Radiating forgiveness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from any hatred or ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding two fixed views, the pure-hearted one having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. So as we start to come to the end of this meditation, maybe we can just reflect on how do I feel in my heart? Do I feel light or heavy? Do I feel rough or smooth? Do I feel like I'm going from a bright place to a brighter place, or from a dark place to a bright place? How do I feel? I like this act of forgiveness. Sometimes we mistake forgiveness and reconciliation. These are very different processes. So forgiveness is where I know what has happened to me, I know how I have suffered. Forgiveness is I acknowledge, I apologize to myself. And forgiveness is where I make an amends to myself. Just like as if I was an 8-year-old and we had a fight, and you would say, make it up to the person that we've had a disagreement with. We make it up. So sometimes I need to make it up to myself. You know, life can be difficult, and life can be a lot of suffering and pain in life. Just the existence, the day-to-day. And then from time to time we have great suffering and troubles. And, you know, it's sometimes we're just being rained on. It's just the season, it's just the time, it's just the place, it's just the conditions, it's not fair, it's just the way it is. But I have this power in my pocket of being able to forgive myself. You know, I can forgive myself for being rained on or for the difficulties that I'm experiencing. I can forgive myself. This is my power. This is very different to reconciliation. Reconciliation is where I make it up with somebody else for a difficulty or a disagreement we've had. For instance, in South Africa, they had the Peace and Reconciliation Commission, where they would get people who had, you know, for instance, police who had tortured, killed people under their custody, and maybe they asked for forgiveness from the victim's family or something like that. And it was a way of for them to help them move on, as well as for the victims to come to a peace. So that's a process of reconciliation. It's not forgiveness. It's a completely different thing. But forgiveness is always in my pocket. I can forgive myself. You know, I'm having a bad day. I'm feeling grumpy. Things are not working out. People are not nice. Things didn't go smoothly. I can forgive myself. And it begins by me acknowledging how life is hurting me. You know, where am I hurt? How am I hurt? How is it manifesting in my life? And when I looked into times where I felt a lot very angry about things, I always realized that I was hurting. You know, I was really angry because I was hurting. And I was really hurting because something had hurt me. Something was hurting me. And I found that I had a secret power in my pocket called forgiveness. I could forgive myself for being hurt. And the more and quicker I got at doing this act of forgiveness towards myself, I could diffuse that hurt and transform it from becoming anger, and then the anger turning into rage, and raging and acting out. And that was very useful to me. It started to really deflate or take a lot of the pressure out of anger morphing into kind of a rage and other dysfunctional ways of dealing with my hurt and my suffering. So this way of being able to forgive myself has been a way for me to actively let go. Letting go is one of the most annoying expressions I come across regularly in Buddhism. Because it's sort of like as if, you know, we had no clue, or we didn't want to let go, or we'd never thought of the idea. But actually, letting go is a whole process, and forgiveness is one of the ways and means that I use to let go of difficulty. You know, hurt is arising because we're, you know, something's hurting us for some reason. Somebody could be could have hurt us in body, in speech, or in mind, verbally, emotionally, spiritually. There's all kinds of ways that we can be hurt by ourselves, by others. But we have this power in our pocket called forgiveness, of where I can forgive myself. Nobody can take that away from me. I don't need the person who has abused me in my life to forgive. You know, that's reconciliation. It's a totally different thing. Maybe the person is dead. You know, maybe the person's a complete SOB and it's never going to happen. Okay? But I can forgive myself. That's my power. And I own that, and I can do something about it. And I can skillfully transform that hurt and anger. Anger is just also protective. It's just empowering me to do something about that hurt. So as long as I can transform that anger into something useful, and so I can take anger and transform it into forgiveness, and that's useful. That's really skillful. But ultimately I can come down to this peaceful place and quiet in my heart, where I have let go of things. You know, I have drained the swamp. You know, and just as the oceans taste of salt, you'll find that genuine forgiveness and coming to peace with the world tastes of peace. It's quiet and it's still. And a few years ago, a friend of mine, he said, you know, you suffered a lot in life, you don't cry enough. And I was looking for a way to make an amends to myself. You know, I'm very good at forgiving others. I can forgive anybody. I learned that as a child. You know, forgive people who are abusing me. Sure, I'll forgive you. But could I forgive myself? No. I didn't know how to do that. And I had to find a way. And my friend was very astute. He said, you don't cry enough. And I was looking for a way to make me cry, and I reflected on things that make me cry, and this radio show is one of those shows. Every time I play it, I play this show a lot, I cry. This is one way to get me going. I've seen a lot of suffering in life. I didn't see the Japanese tsunami, but I was in Burma for the Cyclone Nagas. 140,000 people died, drowned. And I was at the edge of that looking at it. I've seen a lot of stuff. I've been in Sri Lanka for the war. I've been in Northern Ireland. I've been in all sorts of weird places. Plus, whatever life threw at me anyway. But I don't know how to make an amends to myself, and I needed to find that out. And having a good cry, there's something very quiet about it afterwards for me. I thought I'd take a risk and play this for you tonight. But even before I came here, I was actually walking around the monastery up in Serpentine. It's very beautiful. I was watching the sunset, and I was listening to this radio show, kind of in my mind whether I'd play this, come down and play it for you and see how it goes. But it's, you know, just forgiving myself. I can always forgive myself. There's always something to forgive in myself, and for me it's a way of making an amends to myself and doing things that are nutritious for my heart. Well, sometimes I just go and watch a beautiful sunset like I did today, setting down over Rockingham. You know, the beautiful forest up in Serpentine, and watching the Roos. Really, just very nutritious for my soul. You know, so you're invited, you're welcome to come up to the monastery whenever you like. I was going out for a walk and somebody had pulled into the car park and they said, could they walk around? I said, sure, you have permission to walk around. So you're welcome to come up and join us. Sometimes there's a meal, Doug and them invite, they organize things and offer food to the monks in the morning, about 10:30. It's nice. It's very nutritious. Not just for the stomach, but for the heart. And it's by doing these beautiful, kind things for myself that I make an amends to myself. I make it up to me. I don't need to make it up to the people who've screwed me over in my life. I need to make it up to me. I need to apologize to me. Because that's me taking care of me. And I've spent too much of my life not doing that. And I need to find a way of doing that. And one of the ways that I acknowledge the hurt that has occurred in my life is to give myself permission to have a good cry about it. And I like that wind telephone. You know, some people have adopted this idea. I was at home in Ireland in 2015, and somebody had put a wind telephone up in one of the mountains, actually, and then some vandals had destroyed it. You know, which I thought it was fun. But it's a nice idea, you know. Sometimes we need to go to a kind of safe place for ourselves and have a good cry. Or, you know, acknowledge, account for those sufferings that we've experienced in life. And make it up to ourselves. You know. Do something that is really nutritious to ourselves. You know, I don't mean acting out. I don't mean shopping therapy and other things like that. These are superficial things. Find something that's really wholesome and beneficial. Something that would be really kind to yourself. You know, we're the experts in what we need if we give ourselves permission to find out what it is. As a monk, I'm not supposed to really indulge in entertainment, but sometimes I was in Melbourne and I'd go down to the National Art Gallery and I'd just look at something that was in the gallery. It was free to get in, you know, so I don't have money. It's a way of getting in. I can go and see something and either enjoy the beauty of something, a chair or something like that in the gallery, or, you know, enjoy something, some aspect of life, or remember the kind things or the kind people. There's enough wankers in life. They come easily to mind, especially when we're feeling down. But remember the kind people. I had to renew my license because I've moved over to WA, and the person at the driver's licensing department here in Armidale was really kind, very helpful to me. You know, we're talking about blues music. She's a blues singer on the side. We liked a lot of the same singers. You know, finding that connection with decent people is very nourishing to me. I've been away for 4 years. Every day I meet somebody that I haven't seen in a while, you know. It's some really kind people in the world. You know, that's an amends to me, to think about the people who are actually decent, who are actually showing up, who are actually at my back, who are my friends. This is an amends to me. So I really like this ability to forgive myself. I don't need people who have done nasty things to apologize to me. I can apologize to myself. Nobody can take that away from me. And I can do things that are kind and nutritious for myself. This is making an amends to myself. And it gives me the courage to really look at stuff that has been harmful and impactful in my life and make an accountability of that and be clear about it in my mind, that was impactful and that was hurtful. You know, and that I do skillful things, that I avoid running into that trap or that situation again. So this helps me break the cycle of where I've been involved in abusive things that were abusive towards myself. That was really helpful. So I hope that this has been helpful to you tonight. Maybe if you have some questions on what we've been doing, I hope I haven't been overwhelming or otherwise for you. Maybe you want to come here and have a ha 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 and a laugh and a joke. Mm-hmm. We can do that some other time. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it's nice to have one of these, to have a good cry, frankly speaking. And that I can share this sort of sadness. You know, there's a lot of beautiful music that's sad. Chopin, I don't know if you know Chopin, he's a nice piano player and composer. Some of his music's very sad. Some of the most beautiful movies, they have a very sad ending. Sadness has its own power if we know how to manage it well. Not be overwhelmed by sadness, but not be numb to it either. If I'm indifferent to my suffering, if I don't acknowledge it, then I'm just being numb towards it. Of course, when I experience the suffering that has happened in my life, I'm sad. And being able to cry and grieve it in a healthy way is a good thing. Once I don't fall into it and wallow in that sadness. I'll give you an example. I went back to Ireland. I hadn't been back in 20 years. I mean, I visited in between, but I hadn't actually spent much time. You know, and when you're just visiting home, you're it's sort of like a sprint. You know, you're home for 2 weeks and you want to visit all your family and friends, and you know, you have a wedding or an event, and you're in and you're out. You know, but you don't get to actually see and experience things. So a lot has changed in 20 years in Ireland. It's turned upside down in a way. You know, the Celtic Tiger blew through town in a big way. And everything was better. You know, everything was better. You know, it used to be kind of like broken teeth, you know. It had buildings and squares and streets that were a bit wrecked or, you know, damaged. And now everywhere is all fixed up. And I was taking a bus into the city. I was teaching meditation on a Friday night. And, you know, it's a bit of a grind, all the traffic. And I had to change bus. And I knew where the meditation center was. I'd been there before, and I thought, oh, this bus I used to take used to go past the door of it. It was very convenient. If I caught this bus, it would be very convenient. It was called the 10. It was like a famous bus. You know, the number 10 went right across the middle of the city, from the north side to the south side. It was one of these buses, and I jumped off where I could catch the 10. And I was waiting and waiting, and there was an electronic board, so it's all very fancy, telling you exactly what bus is coming and when and how many minutes and where it was going to, you know, that kind of thing. Very useful, but I couldn't find the bloody 10. So eventually I hopped on a bus and I asked the driver, where's the 10, you know? And he said, there's no 10. And it was really weird. I felt incredibly sad in that moment. You know, I got off the bus again because I felt really ashamed. It was like, what do you mean there's no, you know, there's no 10? Like, you know, like, I know there was a 10. There used to be a 10. Like, 20 years ago, there was a 10.
Nice.
But it's gone. There is no 10. And it's really funny how change is associated with sadness. You know, it's not just somebody dies and there's a loss, but there's also a change happening simultaneously. So it's like I could feel sad even though it was better in many ways, you know. The whole city was better, the whole city was cleaner, the buses, everything was better. Let me tell you, it's a lot better. You used to be nearly gassed with the diesel fumes if you took the old buses. And but change was happening, and I had to process that change and grieve it. So I was thinking of Chopin, and I was thinking of all the beautiful sad things that I've, because I don't like sadness myself. I don't like sadness. You know, it's a bit, oh, I'm a bit down, I'm a bit glum, I'm not feeling happy. But like, I had to kind of actually not fight it, and just sort of my way of processing the change, because the whole city is changed upside down and back to front. And it was, you know, so weird to be back. You know, they call it, I came across an expression called migratory grief. Migratory grief is where you're a migrant, you've migrated somewhere else, and then you go back to where you're from, and everything has changed. And everything is upside down. And you grieve it. You have to grieve that change. You know, so all of this kind of grief, you know, is going on in our life all the time, where it's not just that I'm experiencing loss and I feel sad, but also I'm experiencing change and I feel sad. So, you know, I've come back to the monastery, and sometimes some monks say, well, how does it feel? Or people are asking, how is things for you? And stuff like that. You know, you feel a bit embarrassed to say it's actually a little bit sad. But I'm actually grieving the change. The changes in me and the changes in the world around me that are going on. And this helps me to process those changes very quickly, because I'm acknowledging them, and I'm forgiving myself, and I'm making it up to myself. You know, this is really powerful. So sadness isn't my enemy, sadness is my friend, as long as I manage it well, and I deal with it skillfully. And one of the ways that I deal with it skillfully is to not ignore it and numb on the one hand, oh, everything's okay, you know, everything's great, or on the other hand, indulging in it and wallowing into it and falling into sadness, because that's not helpful either. If I can just be sad and grieve it, And one of my ways of doing that is to literally grieve it and have a good cry for myself and play my sad song, as it were. You know, so, I mean, maybe there's some of you who like rock and roll, but I hope some of you still like some country music, you know? Country always has a sad song in there somewhere. or blues. And that we give ourselves permission to grieve the change in our life, to grieve the winter, to grieve the autumn and the winter changes in our life, to grieve that we're getting older, to grieve that we don't have these competences, to grieve any loss or change in our life. And to do this skillfully, to realize that it's a skill, and that sadness and grief can actually be helpful to us if we do it, manage it skillfully, is very useful. So, you know, especially for men, we can feel powerless and weak, and we're not given permission to grieve, just as women are not given permission to be angry, you know. We need to develop skills around those things, or else we're just bottling things up in an unhealthy way. You know, if we can process these things as they arise. You know, so I did go through a sad patch in Ireland, but it transformed, you know, of where I could I'd really accepted that change. And you know what I mean? I could enjoy it. I could, you know, be with all of the change, rather than, I could see people who had lived in Ireland hadn't gone with the changes. They'd kind of like, oh, that whole place has changed, I don't go there anymore. You know, there's nothing for me in that place anymore. You know, they just, you just fall into an ever-decreasing circles, because you're unwilling to open to the changes that are going on in the world, and, you know, accept it rather than going back into the past and wishing it was like the way it was, reminiscing and lost in the past. You know, it's okay. Sometimes it's even better. You know, I think things are better now than they were in the past in many ways. But I need to grieve that change and let go of that former self, my former self, and my former ideas about the way things are and the way things were and the way things should be, and sort of just be with the way things really are. So forgiveness is a very powerful way of letting go. So I'm not giving you sort of, I'm not shaming you by saying, you know, just let go. You know, no, here's a good way, here's something very useful I find that allows me to move towards. And I know I've achieved that goal when I am at peace with the way things are, and I feel very at peace, you know. And I'm not whinging about things. You know, people be whinging, oh, you know, traffic's mad these days, or, you know, oh, it's a bloody mess, and you can't go into that part of the city anymore. It's all one way down there, you know, so it's a mess. It's all foreigners down there. You know, instead I was like, no, it's interesting. It's I'm open to it now. I've allowed that change into my heart. Yeah. Okay, anyway, maybe that's some ideas for you tonight, and if you want, you can, this is on Podbean now, so it's very nice, and that clip was from a radio show. It's called This American Life, and it's episode 597, One Last Thing Before I Go, is called the show, but if you're looking for it, you can just find that on Google. If you have any questions or feedback, that would be useful. Did you enjoy tonight?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Was it meaningful?
Yeah, very much.
Go to the heart?
Yeah.
Did you ever make it to the meditation hall?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I got there. You know, I practice as I preach, you know, and It wasn't that time, but there was another time where I was going and I was on my buses again, and it was a downpour. You know, it was absolutely lashing. And usually when I had thought I had time, I would usually leave early. It would normally take about 2 hours. I would give myself 2 hours to get there, and then I'd get off early and walk the final distance so that I could arrive on time. But, you know, I would take a different route through the city all the time, so I was exploring different areas of the city at the same time. And but anyway, I got snookered one day where I got caught in a downpour, and I was waiting and waiting and waiting for a bus, and I got late for the class, and they were ringing. They phoned me to ask if I'm coming or not, and I said yes, I'm coming. And I was on the bus, and I was actually meditating on the bus, and I got in, and I walked in just like I did now tonight, a friend of mine was at the meditation, and he said afterwards, he said, it was really strange. He said, you were late, you walked in, but you weren't disturbed or anxious or upset. You know, he said, you know, you were just very calm already when you sat down. And I said, yeah, I know, because I was practicing. What do you think I was doing, you know? So these tools are very powerful. You know, like if I tell you that forgiveness is a very good thing to do, yeah, it's a great idea, I love it, yeah, it's a great idea, you know, come on, you know, get off your asses and do it, and then you know how good it is or not, you know. And if you do this a little bit, it comes to you much quicker, you know, day in, day out. So when you're at the traffic light, or you're feeling angry or anxious, you know, you're waiting at the motor department for your license or whatever it is, and you're expecting a runaround. And, you know, like, actually that same day I had to go to Byford, and I had another application to put in, and because I had actually surrendered my license at the department down here, they wouldn't give me the other one because I hadn't enough ID. But I could laugh. The driver was with me, you know, sort of one of the guys were driving us, and I said, well, the clerks won, you know, like, to me it's just a game with the clerks, you know, if I'd done it the other way around, I could have beaten the clerk, but I didn't, and I got beat by the clerk. It was just a game. It was funny, you know. So if you practice these things, you know, we don't carry over those wounds of where we haven't acknowledged the hurt that has happened somewhere else in life. Like, you know, somebody was nasty to us, and we suck it up. We keep going in life, like the little Japanese kids. You know, I'm getting by. But then we lose the head with somebody else where we think we can. Or, you know, we somebody gives us a lousy time at work, and we go home and bite the head off our kids or our partner, you know what I mean? Like, you know, that's space between somebody being a jerk with us and we being a jerk with somebody else. You know, that's an excellent space to put a little bit of forgiveness into. You know, and if that means I've got to pull over in a lay-by and, you know, have a little cry for myself, I think that's worth doing for me to be my better self with those people that I love and I care for, rather than sort of spreading the tough love around, which isn't very nice, you know. But I can take care of my own business, you know. That is my business, how I react or respond to the world.
I talk to my body a lot, and thank it for allowing me to be in this body.
Yeah.
And thank it, and I feel good about that.
Yeah, that's wonderful. You know, I was teaching a friend of mine. He's a dentist, and he obviously drills people's teeth, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of pain involved with dentistry,
came from one.
And he was doing a dental procedure for me, and he was going to, like, anesthetize me up to the wazoo, and I said, I don't think there's any need. Why don't you just, you know, just numb it a little bit and get on with it, you know? And he said, oh, you know, this is a deep root treatment and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, I'll let you know if we can manage it. And you know, as the procedure went on and on and on, I mean, it was fairly, you know. No, it wasn't traumatic. Let's just say it was a definite 8 or a 9 on the pain scale. But on the suffering scale, it was only about a 1 or 2. And I actually got more and more relaxed as the procedure went on. And he asked me what I was doing, and I said to him, well, actually, I just kept relaxing the rest of my body. And what I realized was that a lot of the pain that I was experiencing on the chair was actually that I was just, you know, when you're on a chair for about 45 minutes or an hour, and you've been, you know, clinging onto the arms, actually you're just very stiff and sore.
Yeah.
And so I was just doing that kind of relaxing all the different parts of my body. And actually, the way that the pain works on the dental is it's actually quite intermittent, and you know, there's a lot of attention given because they are rugby tackling your mouth, you know. And I just told him to shut up talking to me, you know, because he wanted to tell me everything he was doing, and I said, I don't want to know, I don't need to know, like, you know, whether you're putting in amalgam or you're going to, you know, I'd figure out that you're going to drill me, you know. I said, that's not useful information, and stop interrupting me, I need to kind of scan my body. So he's been doing this, he's been actually guiding his clients now, and he just wrote me the other day on my email. I can read it out, tell you I'm not rubbishing you. This is what he said about a client the other day, where he had done a guided body scan while tearing into somebody. Oh yeah, just had a 74-year-old patient today who came in extremely nervous. I asked her to let me guide her through it. She got up after the procedure and asked if I was trying to put her to sleep. She seemed genuinely disturbed with having felt so relaxed that she was almost combative initially. She asked me what I was doing. I said that I was guiding her through the process of recognizing and helping her to respond to the procedure. By the end of it, anyway, she was up bouncing around telling me that she was going to tell all of her friends and that she had never experienced anything like it. There you go. So you can forgive yourself while you're lying on the dental chair for being there and having to undergo the suffering and pain, and acknowledge your pain and suffering as you go along, and you know, and not add to your, you know, is suffering to your injury already. And take good care of yourself. So, you know, this is useful stuff. And to the degree that you practice and use this, is to the degree that you'll know for yourself. So, you know, use this. Use this everywhere, and it's very useful. Again, last year I had to have a knee reconstruction, and the anaesthetist was interviewing me before the operation. And he said I was so relaxed before the operation that he changed how he was going to do it. Instead of doing a general anaesthetic, he actually did an epidural. So I was so I had a much better recovery from the epidural, and he was really happy as well because, you know, I had a much better recovery from it. So I was just taking care of myself, you know, and yeah. Being relaxed. And it's quite interesting, you know, all of the operational staff, the theatre, they were actually quite anxious beforehand. So, you know, not allowing their anxiety to affect me. And like, there was a junior surgeon, and he was a Richmond supporter. And I was just joking with him, you know, I said, oh yeah, you know, Richmond's are looking good. And the main surgeon was a Bulldogs fan, and I was like, well, you know, Bulldogs are out of it. What?
He got the chisel there, and he got the saw. He couldn't say things like that.
Well, it wasn't like the head surgeon was there at the time. I was just trying to relax the junior surgeon. Anyway, sorry, you had a question or?
Yeah, I was just going to ask if you think that you can practice techniques like that, or just calming the mind so much that it becomes second nature, and you don't have to consciously think about it. So much.
Well, like we have a saying, and it's that the thought becomes the habit, and the habit becomes the character, and the character becomes the personality. So, you know, we can be our better self, and if we do practice these things, you know, enough, they're a bit like an airbag. You know, they deploy when there's the accident. You know, and I've been really, really surprised time and again. You know, that my good effort has been beneficial to me in my time of need. And that's when it's like, oh, that worked a little bit differently to what I was expecting. You know, like I mentioned earlier on, when I walked into that room and my friend was expecting me to be, you know, like I was late for the meditation class and everything. Like, and you're walking in front of a whole class, and like, you know, like he was like, oh, that was a bit weird. You know, and that becomes normal to me, and that's very, very liberating. you know, where I'm liberated from suffering, the suffering that I would have had if that had been, like, you know, I could have taken it personally with the clerks the other day, you know, like, you know, it's not personal. The clerks are not being personal, you know, they just, you need all of this ID to do that and blah blah, and that's it. And if you don't, I was like, oh, okay, I could have, if I hadn't my license and everything, I had everything, I had the paperwork, I had the slip, you know, I would have, if the police had stopped me, they would have said, okay, yeah, you know, your license is in the mail, but they were like, no, we need to see your license, you know. I wasn't upset about it, you know. And it's like, oh, okay, you know, thanks Buddha, thanks for that teaching and the training, and thanks to my own effort, you know. And in that way, forgiveness is very empowering, you know. Nobody can take it. I don't have to go down to somebody who's been nasty to me and say, you owe me an apology, you know, or else I don't have any forgiveness here. No, I forgive myself. Nothing to do with me, what they do, you know. And that's wonderful, that's very freeing. Yeah.
Thanks for taking the step to share something different and be innovative and courageous, because to be skillful in life, it's good to be able to have access to as many different media you can apply to it and find your way to use those things and get through it. On the aspect of dealing with grief, humour is an interesting way to take a different perspective into the situation, rather than just be one-dimensional about it. Little story, I was in the election office many years ago, and I put my wallet down on the table in the election office and picked up my paperwork to vote, and turned around to pick up my wallet and it was gone, it had been stolen. And I got a bit upset about that. The fellow behind the counter says, oh, I didn't notice anything yet, but the real theft will start after the election's over. And I thought that was quite funny. I think he was trying to make a point about our choices and who we had to vote for. But looking at the other aspects in the situation helps a lot too, rather than just being focused on one thing. Because it's not monodimensional. There's many dimensions to a situation.
Yeah, it's... Like, I have to say that humor is something that I think we have to be careful around, you know, because like, you know, it's wisdom because it's funny, like, where we can laugh at ourselves and we can laugh at our situation, but that doesn't mean to say that a joke or humor can be skillful. It can be dismissive and it can be numbing to the situation or indifferent. So, you know, we can be demeaning. We can be demeaning to ourselves. Like, I shouldn't suffer, or I shouldn't, you know, like, I mean, I had it as a kid, like, you know, what are you crying about? You know, I'll put the smirk on the other side of your face or something like that. Like, and, you know, as if it's funny, you know, it's not funny. You know, I've seen humor used all over the place where it's just dismissive of people's suffering. Whereas the kind of thing I was trying to guide towards tonight is actually finding that skillful regime that's reaching the suffering. Because numbing is a big way, and, like, to be honest, men are the biggest numbers in the world when it comes down to suffering and grieving, because we learn boys don't cry, and, you know, if you're powerless, suck it up, you know. And you know, like, I mean, to be honest, that was a voting officer also not taking responsibility that thieves had walked in on the middle of before the election, to be frank. You know what I mean? So you were getting cleaned out before and after the election. But you know, like, and I see that a lot, of where humor and that gets very dismissive. Anyway, I think we've hit the 8:30 mark. You know where to find us up in the monastery, and we'll be here again next week. Over to Doug.
Okay. Thank you very much, Vante, for your talk tonight and meditation.
Welcome.
I normally ask people to turn their phones off, but you're forgiven.
That was a record. That was a player.